Yeah, I asked that my Dharma talk be scored today, so that's what's come up. It's an inspirational talk. Okay, is this helpful, the microphone? Is it good level? We're all good with that? Okay. For reals with the music, I'm just kidding. Okay. Well, the subject of my talk, the title of the talk, is to study the self. By that, what is this process of observing the self in the context of our meditative practice? So in the context of Buddhist meditation. So how might one pick up that idea? What might those words mean? And really, I'll mostly be sharing what kind of angles on that idea and practices have been helpful for me in particular. You know, one way of thinking of any way of practicing within a Buddhist context, whatever the tradition, whatever the the stripe, whatever the practice, it's about somehow encouraging us to be able to have more insight into how we take ourselves. So to open up the possibility of knowing different perspectives, opening up a freedom in how we relate to ourselves and our experience. So that's kind of the terrain I'll be covering a bit. The phrase to study the self, I pulled from a quote from Zen Master Dogen. It's something that people quote often, and it begins, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self." It's from a lovely, profound text called the Genjo Koan that I won't really be going into today. But I like the phrase, "to study the self." It kind of struck me a certain way. And I could see, just in looking at the translations of the Dogen quote, seeing the words different translators picked and how kind of important the language choices are, particularly if we're studying, we're studying Buddhism, all of the texts we're getting are translations from a different language, maybe from a different language. And we're talking about, or we're hearing about, learning about concepts and how to practice, things that until we've experienced them ourselves, until we've begun to practice, until we have a direct relationship with them, the language can actually weigh kind of heavy. So that, looking at the words, sometimes the word study was, the translator chose the word learn. So to learn the Buddha way is to learn about the self. And the word study kind of, for me, that opened something up that was useful or inspiring. The word study, it has a kind of, efforting in it, or a commitment, or some sort of application of grit. You know, if we have a long-term, like longer than a day, meditation practice, usually we have to bring some sort of intention. There's also something about a kind of quality of like an observational intimacy with the word study for me. I can kind of imagine what is it for like a biologist to commit to 5 years in the wild looking at some sort of creatures and learning, taking maybe a scientific perspective, setting aside preconceptions and just seeing what comes, that kind of connected commitment. For an artist, the word study, it describes like a some sort of preparatory sketch, but very often it's an observational sketch or a sketch from life. So, if I'm going to do a painting of a tree, I could just do it from the comfort of my studio and, draw what a tree is to me, but I would be limited by what ideas I had about the tree. So I might choose to go out into nature, go out into whatever weather's going on, whatever bugs, or maybe people hassling me, something like that. But I would choose to do that because it would make available a kind of freshness in what I receive from what I'm doing the study of, what I'm looking at. There's something about being in the space, kind of connected by the space and opening in relationship. So those are just some shadings that kind of came to me from the word study. noticing that I liked it. And noticing that why I liked it would be specific to me, you know, my relationship to the language. So talking about the idea of self, what is the relationship of language to that? If we come into a, you know, a Buddhist center, words going to come up, you know. There's ideas about of no self or not self. What is, how we take the that word, how we take those ideas will have something to do with where we're coming from. You know, are we talking about the personality? Are we talking about, you know, the ego in a psychological sense, or my thinking process, or, you know, how I relate to my life? Those might all, we might react differently. I noticed for myself, there were some ways of hearing that language that were kind of a block for me. When I first started practicing, I was like, you know, my relationship to who I am in my life, that is where what is fulfilling in my life kind of comes through to me. And hearing languaging that, and maybe I didn't even hear it, but I just kind of, my being kind of responded in a certain way until I began to practice, you know, until I began to follow the practice instructions, maybe brought some kind of, you know, fear up. What does it mean to, you know, see beyond the self, transcend the self? Sometimes kind of like almost like warrior language is used. Like, you know, you'll hear people say something like, you know, this is about eradicating the ego, something like that. That kind of language was something that I had to kind of find my own way into and learn from teachers and develop my own understanding to see that was really not the direction that freedom goes in. You know, the direction when we begin to look at ourselves, look at what is going on here, we begin to actually be able to have a broader range of ways to relate to who we are. It opens up a kind of freedom to kind of touch into different ways to know ourselves, ways to know our experience. So this process of examining the self, studying the self, is really about looking for what puts in place the limitation or the fixation that prevents us from being able to kind of dance more freely with our life, something like that. The language for me that's been kind of helpful is that we're unburdening ourselves of that which limits us. We're unburdening ourselves of that which makes us feel disconnected, separate, finite, kind of locked in and locked down. And that's where a lot of the suffering comes from in our experience. Maybe helpful to give an example of kind of the direction this can go as we begin to look at our how we relate to ourselves and this process of, that opens up with the possibility that comes from observing what's going on with ourselves. One role that I'm identified with is being a mother. You know, is something that's just true. I'm a mom. That's part of my life. It's a done deal. There are ways, for sure, that my spiritual practice informs how I parent, and even why I chose to parent. Having a sort of, like a reservoir of a sense of, a kind of confidence in experience. Contact with a sense of oneness. Contact with a sense that there is something transcendent that can nourish us. Like, all of that comes into how I parent. Would not be an adequate way to do all of my parenting, you know, from a place of, I don't know what, you know, some sort of transcendent interconnectedness. It requires the specificity, and requires moving into different ways of relating to myself. So my son, let's say he's in Target and he really, you know, wants me to buy him a toy. And, you know, when he was even a little bit younger, around 4, like sometimes that would be like a huge kind of public explosion. And I would have a rising of feelings of like, how does this look? And, you know, do I look like that mom? And my son is this kid. And but if I have a little distance, a little ability to kind of shift around how closely identified I am to how I look, or what my son says about me, then I can just kind of get in there and I can just attend to him in a kind of caretaker position. And I can give him what he needs in the moment and also offer him what will support his growth in the right direction. There's other times in our relationship where I know what he needs is he just needs me, like my specific, you know, his mom, Susie, you know, to know him for who he is, specific personality, you know, specific manifestation of, you know, whatever larger connectedness. It also arises in just Felix. So to be seen and to be known that way, we do that for each other as people. And that's, you know, it's kind of unspeakably beautiful. So this whole range, moving, you know, being able to know myself as interconnected, know myself as connected to, you know, all beings, and all the way down to, like, you know, hey, kid, like, you know, something like that. That's the direction, you know. So it's not an eradication. It's not looking at this process of practice, process of meditation, examining ourselves. And we're not looking for, like, the one thing that we have to pull out. It's not, you know, some aspect of our personality. It's not something to do with our thinking. Instead, it's opening up this relationship. How can we move in relationship to those things? What can be possible there? So what then if we're not looking to I'll just kind of point out that the Buddha did not define what the self was, you know. Instead, he handed us some tools or some practices, some ways of looking at our experience, and particularly how we take ourselves to be and relate to our experience, as ways that could open up this possibility for freedom, this open up this possibility to suffer less. He didn't say whether or not the self existed, you know. He said, and probably what self meant in his times for sure was specific to the time, but he refused to answer that question because he said that's not a useful use of our energy if we want to relieve ourselves of suffering. What's useful is to examine why we suffer, yeah, and begin to look there. So he gave the cause of our suffering, he said, was craving, meaning our attachment to our experience, a kind of attached relationship to our experience. So suggested that, you know, if we want to release our suffering, to look there. They're playing the wrong part of the music. So how might we begin then not to look at what to remove from our experience or to remove from how we see ourselves, but instead open up this possibility to move freely, looking then at the activities of mind, sort of, you know, in the way that the Buddha pointed, this activity of mind is craving. What are the activities of our mind that cause us to feel fixed, stuck, limited? Maybe to break down the idea of craving a little bit into some parts that we might begin to become sensitive to as we meditate in our practice. The first aspect, maybe I'll just name three. So the first aspect would be the habit of mind that is kind of orienting ourselves towards experience through me, you know, through where I am. It's kind of a self-referential perspective. So when I observe things, when I encounter things, could be ideas too, there's always an element of my relationship to that kind of imbued in it almost. So, you know, if I see a person that's I have a relationship to, that's my friend, this is my body, the things of my life, my house, my car, on that level it's true. It's also true in terms of, you know, just on a perceptual level, when something arises, kind of built into it, I know how far away from me it is. It works kind of on all of these levels, this kind of self-referencing. In terms of the process of craving, you know, we're looking at my relationship to the object. Do I want this thing or do I want to push it away? Another kind of aspect we can look at is what might be called the judging mind or the comparing mind. So how do we know we want to pull it towards us or push it away? You know, part of it is like, it's good for me or it's bad for me. You know, it's harmful for me, it's helpful for me. Sometimes that is called the dualistic mind, because it kind of functions through opposites. There's other ways that expression is used, but one way to describe dualistic thinking is, you know, it's always assessing things through these kind of binary pairs, on, off, good, bad, long, short, something like that. So that's kind of part of one of these habits of mind that we can begin to become sensitive to. Another habit would be a kind of preferencing certainty, something like that. Not being so comfortable with ambiguity and really wanting to kind of lock things down quickly. That's a kind of habit of mind that we can notice as well. You may have heard there's a teaching, an example sometimes teachers will use. You see a rope on the ground and it's dusk and the mind just goes, whoa, that's a snake. The mind just will kind of fixate what is maybe kind of gray information, not so clear, and choose to prefer to solidify somehow, make something solid. So that tendency to want to be certain and not being uncomfortable maybe in areas that are not so clear, that's another one of these tendencies of mind. And they all kind of come together in a way and kind of filter our perspective somehow. As I describe these things, you can probably maybe relate them to like evolutionary drives, or you know what we need to do to preserve ourselves. So, I'm out in nature, you know, what is that thing? You know, what's its relationship to me? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Fast, you know, you kind of need to know that. So in that, like, nothing inherently wrong with these tendencies of mind. It's not like in fact, they're very good, very helpful. We would never want to live without them. But we can kind of see that maybe that they kind of run amok a bit. You know, this sort of way of thinking, when applied to things like, you know, what somebody said about me or something I did wrong, once we start sitting, we begin to notice our mind maybe spending a lot of time evaluating situations. What's my relationship to it? It's this person's fault? It's my fault? I'm really sure about it. There is no other perspective than my own. We can begin to see this is kind of spinning and causing a kind of suffering that is maybe not 100% warranted. Yeah, a lot of our energy and time is spent kind of with this process going on about things that are not life-threatening. And that's something that we can begin to release. And we can, begin to release where that kind of thinking and way of orienting ourselves is not skillful, not useful. We can probably see this in our society, you know, this very self-centered orientation, very kind of judgmental, I'm right, my perspective. You know, how does that play out in a globalized world with a lot of power imbalances? You know, it doesn't play out well. So we can begin to look at that and relieve some suffering for ourselves. Let go, have a little freedom, a different kind of perspective as we continue to practice. Maybe one other aspect of beginning to take a look at how these habits of mind that limit us work. It's not just about being able to maybe relieve some level of suffering that's not essential. It's also true that whatever we're bringing to our experience, whatever kind of information we're privileging or prioritizing, like if what's most important to me is what I can directly relate to myself and be clear about, that kind of filters how we receive our experience, and that's extremely significant. What kind of information, what kind of aspects of our experience is deemed to be the most relevant? When I was younger, I worked in printing. I worked in the graphics department of print shops, and one of my jobs was to like cut a silhouette or cut a mask around an image, and whatever was outside of the lines wouldn't print. So they give me a picture of a guy and they say, like, we just want the mandaprint and whatever extraneous junk was in the background, not print. So I would carefully draw the line. Whatever the tendencies of our mind are, the habits of our mind will kind of sort and privilege what we see, you know, what comes into us, what we experience. Drop out what isn't relative. Hide it. Yeah. So this idea that how our habits of mind, whatever is dominant, particularly if it's not something that we are conscious of, it will actually hide, conceal, remove aspects of our experience. So if we talk about, you know, how do these habits of mind relate to us feeling separate? How do they relate to us feeling limited? How does our experience become narrow, self-centered, kind of lonely in a way? You know, it's part of it is due to these habits of mind kind of hiding, obscuring, something like that. Yeah. Is it when, on an experiential level, what we don't see, you know, what we're not tuned into, it doesn't exist. You know? So it's like the role of these, whatever our habits of mind are in shaping our experience, is a very significant thing to explore. So through practice, we can begin to explore different habits of mind. You know, that's one way of looking at what are these practice instructions. They are, when we take them on, they counteract these kind of tendencies, limited, limiting perspectives somehow. And that becomes available to us to try on through meditative practice. And it has to be meditative practice because it's about exploring possibilities that go deep, you know. It's not just what's going on in the thinking level. It's like all the way down to how we receive our senses. But we can practice and begin to open up the possibility to change the shape of the mask, drop the mask entirely. And this is where these possibilities to seeing ourselves differently, experiencing a different relationship to other people, to what is possible for us to, you know in this human life. What the time is. Yeah, I'll just say a little bit more specifically on practice. So, you know, we all sat together today, and we all started by being quiet, being still, stopping. Some of us may be focused on our breath, a really simple object of attention. That's a radically different stance to take towards our experience, you know, just the act of like putting down, you know, the machine or whatever, you know, the orienting myself, comparing, is just setting it down. So what that does on a fundamental level, or you know, it's like the first step, but it's the most important step, is it like lets us know that's possible. You know, it's possible to stop. It's okay. The being can kind of intuit this is okay. And that's kind of the first step in moving into a different relationship somehow. One direction, one path begins to open. Can I not judge everything and compare anything? Yeah, I can for like at least 5 or 10 seconds. And then that can become more. So again, it's not necessarily like this, oh, I get it. It's more like a over time, allowing for a kind of unfolding. Another possibility for us when we sit would be maybe to kind of relate differently to this judging mind, this comparing mind. I think I maybe gave the instruction, maybe not, that you can be curious about your experience. I'm sure you've all heard that if you've been, you know, practicing much. You can be curious about your experience. That's a different way to receive experience than like sort out the good from the bad and push away what you don't want. Okay, be curious. What might I learn? What might come to me? Different stance, and it begins to sort of inform what's possible for us. Another sort of similar slant on that is, what is it to welcome experience, allow experience, open to experience, be receptive? That's sometimes part of meditative instruction. You know, it's a different relationship again. I think Tara Brach has an expression, radical acceptance. It's a similar kind of stance that we can take. And maybe helpful, again, to come back to this idea of language, too. These things that I'm throwing out are words. And to, you know, like the idea of radical acceptance, at certain points in my life, I would be like, you know, no, thank you. What I need to do is, like, learn how to, like, radically set boundaries for myself, you know. When we hear these ideas and we take them just as ideas, can bring up all sorts of stuff and resistance. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that kind of work. I'm just saying that's not what what is on offer with meditative practice is different. So instead, it's like, try it out. You know, just, I can do anything for 45 minutes. You know, see how that feels to the being. Give myself permission to kind of shift my relationship to experience. And there will be a kind of unfolding in a natural way, you know, over time. So it's something different. Maybe I'll say one last thing. I talked a little bit about becoming sensitive to how, kind of where we're at, how we're working, what habits of mind are kind of dominant. Is it judging? Is it orienting things relative to myself? What does this mean to me? Whatever it is, we can begin to notice the relationship between where we're at and how our experience kind of presents in real time. We can do that on the cushion. That's possible for us. And the kind of insight we get into what I'm adding to my experience that is significantly impacting it, we begin to learn there. Again, on this kind of experiential level, you know, when I take some time to become sensitive, not just to what's coming into my senses, observing outward, but also get in the habit of observing inward, then I can begin to sort of sense the interplay. So if there's like a person who's, you know, I'm in a snarl with somebody at work, and I decide to do metta for them as a practice, you know. So check in with myself, see where I'm at. Maybe I have a lot of thoughts going on. It's their fault. It's my fault. It's, you know, I'm engaged that way. Do the practice. Notice what shifts. Yeah. So notice what goes on here, what happens in my being. Am I thinking less? Are my thoughts less reactive? Are they maybe about a sort of different tone somehow? Maybe less only focused on what's going wrong, and instead it opened up a little bit. You know, am I quieter? Is there any shift there? And then I can see what happens with the person who in question, the person I'm having an issue with. Do they appear differently to me? Is there less, maybe less anger, less agitation somehow? Can I see more of them? Can I see what's good about that person? You know, can that begin to balance out the picture, not just what's pertaining to this, to the situation I have with them? That can kind of open up. Maybe I can see what causes and conditions came into play with the situation, not just on their side, but also on my side too. So it's like an opening. There's room for multiple perspectives, maybe, that can happen. That's different than kind of being on this track, these habits of mind that are very limiting. And when we begin to you know, tune into that in our practice and kind of see the back and forth, it can begin to unfold very deeply in terms of insight into the nature of how we Buddhist-y way to say it would be how we fabricate our experience, but how what we bring to our experience builds it, impacts it somehow. Maybe I'll just end with like an actual Dogen quote from the Genjo Koan that kind of speaks to this a little bit. When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. So it's not just the looking at the stuff, but also studying the self involves the sensitivity to what's going on here. And the self, you know, in a way, we know it through the interplay between the two, you know. How our experience shows up for us, what we see, what is available to us is kind of intimately tied to how we're experiencing ourselves somehow. The quote continues, "Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self." So you kind of know, intuit on that level, the possibility for a fluidity. And it's not like a dissolving, maybe it could be, but not in the way that I'm speaking about it. It's that's what allows the dance. That's what allows the movement. Yeah, seeing that relationship between the two and the lack of a fixed, this is one way, this is me, this is it. You know, I'm all alone here. It can have this beautiful interplay, freedom to it somehow. So that's what I had to share today. And we have a little bit of time together where if you have questions, you can ask questions. If you want to share about, what went on for you in the sit today, or something maybe that's unrelated, but specifically about your meditative practice,